Refreshing Reflections. I'm Sean Scott, and today I'm reading the August 2019 issue of The Guidepost. I begin with New Beginnings, Something New, by Chanel Ellison of Lake Claire, Iowa. My boys were growing up. Was I growing with them? I woke to pounding, bam, bam, bam. What was that racket? I got up and looked out the window. My husband and the two youngest of my five boys were in the side yard working under the canopy of our Norway maple. Twos lay scattered on the ground. They were taking apart the boys' wooden swing set. I ran to the porch door. "What are you doing?" I shouted. My son stopped working, and my husband, Lonnie, walked over. "I guess I should have given you a heads up," he said. "I'm sorry. The boys haven't used the playset for a long time." He tugged at the bill of his baseball cap. We decided it was time to take it down. I'd known this would happen sooner or later. Little boys grow into bigger boys, and bigger boys have so many other things to do. Swim club, baseball, and soccer. My youngest Isaiah was 10, and the next youngest one, Gabriel, was 12. But I wasn't ready. "You're right," I said. "We should have talked." Lonnie tried to hug me, but I pulled away. He understood that taking down the swing set was hard for me. Maybe it was hard for him, too. But a mama's soul is different. And this meant the end of an era. Change was happening and would continue fast and hard. I followed the path that cut through the side yard to get a better look at the destruction. The sight of the discarded wood planks made my hands close tight. "How could you?" I whispered. As frustrated as I was with my men for not letting me in on this project, the true deep frustration was with myself. How many times would I fall into this same chasm? I thought. I'd learned to deal with the children growing up with a fair amount of strength and grace even. After all, my oldest was in law school. My next was well on his way out of the nest, too. I'd set my boys free to go to a public school after years of home teaching. Yet here I was again, wanting to freeze time, to box and store the days as if there were no expiration date on their childhoods. The swing set had come to us on the back of a flatbed truck more than a decade ago, when my older sons were 12, 9, and 2. We'd just moved from a tiny cottage to an old Victorian, and the wooden play set was the first thing we'd unpack. Whatever adventure they tackled on it became my own. Pirates who hauled loot to the top platform with a bucket and rope. Cowboys wielding wooden rifles. We draped bed sheets over the tower to make a canopy tent and scooped sand in the box below. A baby swing was hung from the center bar when two more sons were born. Then came the big boy swings and a trapeze. Next, a set of rings. I spent hours behind those swings, pushing babes and toddlers and boys while we sang made-up songs and the sun browned their skin and turned their hair a summer white. I miss those times as my boys grow. No more afternoons playing or reading books together in the tower. Instead, we spent hours in the family van running here and there from one activity to the next. There was no way that the future could be as sweet as the past, was there? The boys stacked the time-worn wood. I couldn't watch anymore. I went back to the house. Maybe a run would help me sort through my emotions. My oldest son, Logan, stood on the porch. He was home for a rare weekend visit from law school. "I'm leaving for a run, too," he said. "Want to go together?" I nodded. A few minutes later, we ran behind our house. City blocks gave way to country roads and farmland. "The swing set," Logan said. "It's hard for you, right?" "It is." Logan knew how I resisted change. I'd kick and scream to keep things the same if it would make a difference. I'd ask God over and over to help me live with my hands open, to release the memories I clung to so I'd be ready for what he planned next. For it didn't take long for fear to creep in again, to make me feel as if the ground were crumbling from under me. "You're really good at this, Mom, raising boys," Logan said. I looked at my grown son, slim and strong, kind to slow his pace to mine, kind to know my struggle and to meet me where I was emotionally. "Thanks, Logan," I said. I wanted my boys to grow into the people the Lord intended them to be. Why couldn't I just roll with things? Because taking down the swing set was more than dismantling ropes and wood. The empty space in the yard made room for a question. After the wild beauty of raising kids, could life ever hold the same luster? Our yellow lab barked in greeting when he saw Logan and me coming down the hill toward home. I could see from this vantage point that the activity in the yard continued. "I think I'll run down the block and go in the front door," I said. I could look the other way as I ran past the wrought iron fence that had once held my children safe away from the road. But as I came closer, my two youngest yelled for me, "Mom, look! Come see!" That was the last thing I wanted to do. I imagined the dirt patches in the yard, bare, brown from years of sneakers, scuffing the grass under the swings. I thought about the joy of those little boys years ago when we first anchored that swing set under the outstretched arms of our Norway maple. Isaiah called again, and Logan nodded in encouragement. I walked over the drive and opened the gate, took the 5 steps down to the patio, careful to look at my feet and not into the yard. "Mom, see?" Gabriel grabbed my hand. "We finally did it. We wanted one for so long. Look at Isaiah." I felt my gaze settle in the side yard. My chest tightened at the reveal of the energy of the empty space. But then, there was my youngest in the tree. Isaiah stood on a platform that had been built into the lower branches of the maple. His smile shone with pride. The wooden ladder that once led to the tower of their playset leaned against the trunk. Though Isaiah stood on just a few narrow planks of wood, I caught the vision. A treehouse in the making. A tall, high, hidden place for growing boys. The swing set was being transformed into something different, something new. Though the structure wasn't the same, the wood was. And this treehouse, it held fresh promise. I could imagine the boys having sleepovers up there, sleeping bags rolled out and flashlights glinting like fireflies on a summer night. I imagined them playing games and reading books and shooting slingshots under the cover of leaves. The best part? They couldn't wait to share their joy with me. They were talking a mile a minute as they climbed the ladder and jumped down and then climbed up again. As they dreamed bigger boy dreams out loud, I noticed Logan pick up tools to help. I remembered his words of encouragement, the kind of love and wisdom that comes from a grown-up heart. "It's beautiful," I said. "Beautiful," Isaiah said, scrunching up his face. "It's a guy place, Mom." But I wasn't talking about the treehouse. I was thinking about life, about how it can't stay the same, ever. But if only I'd let it, all that was old and outgrown can be transformed into something exciting and new, something wonderful. I looked up at my sons in their new treehouse. This time, my smile matched theirs. Mysterious Ways by Douglas Wells of Valparaiso, Indiana. It was a beautiful July evening, the sky still bright. I had all the windows down as I drove home from work, the smell of mowed grass drifting in on the breeze. I rolled to a stop at a red light. I found myself not wanting it to change. I didn't relish going home to an empty house. My life had been in a tailspin ever since my wife told me that our marriage was over, that she'd met someone else. She filed for divorce soon after that. 2 years later, I was still struggling. The traffic light turned green. I eased my foot on the gas just as I drove through the intersection. A thought popped into my head, so clear it was almost a command. Pray for your wife. That's the problem, I thought. I don't have a wife. But the idea was so insistent. I pulled over to the side of the road, sitting there in the car with the engine ticking as it cooled and my hands clasped in front of me. I felt a little silly, but I was here, wasn't I? Might as well. I didn't know what to say, so I just asked God to protect her and remind her that he loved her. Amen. I concluded hastily before getting back on the road. The strange episode soon slipped my mind, until the next year. That's when I finally felt ready to date again. I made a profile on a dating website and was matched up with a woman named Nancy. She and I seemed to share a lot of the same values and interests, and she had a beautiful smile. Nancy and I hit it off right away. In fact, we had more in common than I would have guessed from her profile. Her husband had left her the previous year. It was a dark time for me, Nancy told me over dinner. I didn't think I'd get through it. When was this? I asked, but I already knew the answer. July of last year, she replied. I nodded, but didn't say anything. Only several days later would I tell her about the compulsion to pray that had come over me that beautiful summer evening. Nancy and I will soon celebrate our 19th wedding anniversary. Every day of these 19 years we have spent together, I have prayed for my wife. The wife God told me to pray for before we'd even met. Cover story, Your Greatest You, by Trent Shelton of Fort Worth, Texas. He's the most popular motivational speaker of his generation, but his success began in failure. I sat on the bed in my old room in my parents' house in Fort Worth, looking at the pictures on the walls, the trophies lining the shelves. Football. It had always been about football. In high school and college at Baylor, where I'd been a star wide receiver, dreaming of making it big in the NFL. Now those plaques and trophies seemed to taunt me. You're a failure. You're a loser. I didn't get picked in the NFL draft, so I started out as an undrafted free agent with the Indianapolis Colts. They were fresh off a Super Bowl title. This was 2007. I figured I'd be here to help them get another ring. Peyton Manning and I would be making big plays all over the field. Big plays. In training camp, I turned heads, bawling out. I'm going to make this team, I told myself. Yet the Colts didn't play me. They're just trying to hide you. Veteran players said, keep other teams from signing you. The Colts cut me instead. I was re-signed to the practice squad, then got cut from that. That was the first time I holed up in my bedroom. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I felt humiliated. Since I was a kid, I talked about being a star in the NFL. What was I going to say now? A week later, the Colts called me back to the practice squad. A second chance. Coach Tony Dungy talked about putting me in a Monday night game. Then something went wrong with my knee. I tried to suck it up and play through it. Coach saw me limping and told me there was no way I could be activated if I wasn't able to go full speed. That was it with the Colts. The next season, the Seattle Seahawks invited me to a mini camp They cut me at the end of the preseason. They wanted me to come back. I packed my stuff, rushed to the airport, all ready to board. My phone rang. Seattle again. They changed their minds. Another receiver had become available. Someone who will fit into their plans. Someone better than me. I got another shot with the Washington Redskins. I ran my fastest time in the 40-yard dash, 4.3 seconds. Elite speed. The Redskins signed me to the practice squad, but I never played a game. By November, I was, you guessed it, cut. I still wasn't ready to face the truth. I tried arena football where the smaller fields of turf laid over concrete were brutal on my body. Then I signed up to play for the United Football League right before it went belly up. I went into a spiral, smoking, drinking, partying. I got a woman pregnant. I might have been the son of a preacher, but I wasn't acting like it. Around that time, my college roommate Anthony Arlane took his life, a Baylor football star like me. He'd also had a short-lived NFL career. Like me, he'd gone into a tailspin when his football dreams ran up against reality. Was that my fate? Retreating to my old bedroom this time felt like the bitter end of everything. I turned away from the photos of me snagging a touchdown, all the trophies and plaques. They held no positive meaning for me anymore, only reminders of failure. How was I going to move forward? How was I going to support my son? What kind of role model was I going to be? I sat and wept bitter tears. God, who am I now without football? Why did you give me this dream just to take it away? I prayed harder than I had ever prayed before. Then it came to me. Rehab time. Athletes rehab from all sorts of injuries and setbacks. Wasn't I also struggling with a setback? A big setback. I started out by hitting the gym with a dude from church. We'd go there in the middle of the night when the place was empty, pumping iron, pounding on the treadmill, holding each other accountable. I needed my friend to watch out for me as I watched out for him. I had to remake myself inside and out. I pored over the Bible. I drove to the mall and hung out at Barnes & Noble, sitting at one of those tables reading every self-help book and inspirational book that I could get my hands on. I get glimpses of what I needed to do, but you can't remake yourself all at once. You need to take it in stages. I had to face up to the truth of who I was, not who I imagined myself to be. I made short videos of what I'd learned and posted them online, passing on the advice. Rehab time, I called it. One of my new rules for living was to thank God at the beginning of each day before even getting out of bed. Thank God for the life I was given. Thank God for my parents, my son. Set things right. I was just a former football player, not a preacher, author, or media star. But I got a call out of the blue. A guy I knew from Baylor asked me to speak at his church. Who am I supposed to speak to? I asked. A bunch of teenagers, he said. How many of them would be there? 5,000, he said. 5,000 for my first speaking engagement? How long was I supposed to talk? 5 minutes, he said. 5 minutes? It might as well have been 5 hours. I tried not to break out. I wrote down all the things I should say. I rehearsed them over and over in my head. But the minute I stepped on stage, my mind went blank. I had no idea how to help these teens. All I could talk about was what I'd been through. I took a deep breath, opened my mouth, and spoke from the heart. No notes, no filter, just me straight up. Those kids peppered me with questions afterward, hungry for more. I got a huge ovation, bigger than I ever got on the football field. That's when it hit me. You don't have to be perfect to help people. All you have to do is be real. My life was coming together. I was working at being a good dad, a good son, a good friend, without even planning it. I had a whole new calling. I began posting to YouTube every day. The videos took off, getting thousands of views, hundreds of thousands, millions. It was both humbling and awe-inspiring. The comments and questions came pouring in, people asking for advice. Help I'd never be able to offer if I were playing on Sunday. Help that came from my own struggles. One day, I picked up the Bible my mother had given me way back in high school. On the cover was a football with the initials NFL. I'd always thought it was a reference to my football dreams, but then I noticed that the letter also stood for something else. New found life. On the first page, Mom had quoted Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Thus was my newfound life. Today I'm happily married with 2 kids and another on the way. I do a lot of speaking engagements, and every day I post a video and respond to all those questions from people, always trying to be honest, speaking from the heart. Admittedly trying to keep up with 10 million Facebook followers and 1.6 million on Instagram can be tough. One morning, I woke up and checked my phone before I even got out of bed. Ding, ding, ding. I was being bombarded. How would I ever keep up? I started typing answers. Something on Twitter caught my eye, and I went to retrieve it. Then I stopped myself. What was I doing? Hadn't I told people that the best way to start the day is with gratitude? Didn't I believe in doing that myself? No wonder I was so stressed. Physician, heal yourself. Treat. It's rehab time. I put down the phone and went for a hike. There are some great trails near our house, great for exercise and fresh air. Best of all, my phone doesn't even work out there. No signal, nothing to take me away from where I am. I have a new way to start the day now, to protect my peace and to connect with God. I go for a hike first thing. For 45 minutes, nothing else matters. It's just God and me. So you see, I'm still at work in a progress. We are here. We all are. There are so many ways to grow. There is so much to learn and pass along. So much to discover. Not long ago, I was back at that Barnes & Noble where I used to sit for hours studying book after book, learning from people who seemed so wise, so full of faith. This time I was sitting in front of a huge stack of books, signing copies, because this book was my own, The Greatest You, by Trent Sheldon. Me, a published author, who could have ever known? When God says He'll give you back better than what you lost, believe Him. Someone Cares, Sit and Rest, by Marilyn Delisle Stroob of Reed City, Michigan. My husband Joe and I got a great housewarming gift from my brother. He built us a wooden bench for our porch. We live on a hill that overlooks a river and walking path. Joe and I decided the bench would get more use next to the path. We were right. We could see how glad people were to have a place to sit and rest. The next year, Joe and I added a lidded trash can so folks who wanted to enjoy a snack while they sat wouldn't have to carry away their garbage. The year after that, we put out a small cooler of water bottles, along with a large metal dog bowl for the dog days of summer. If visitors see us working in our rock garden, they shout out their thanks. But our favorite form of appreciation comes in the form of licks and nuzzles. We can't have dogs of our own because of allergies, so we are more than happy to accept the love of furry friends passing through. Thanks all around. By Peggy Friesen of New York. Let's find Cinderella, my 4-year-old granddaughter said during a recent trip to Walt Disney World. She ran ahead, then promptly fell and skinned her knee. Before I knew it, a cast member, Disney speak for employee, appeared with some ice, a slushie, and a colorful marshmallow treat. Thank you, I said, but it didn't seem enough. Good thing I'd come prepared with tiny note cards on which I printed thank you for making our day magical. I gotten the idea when I was at our grocery store back home and a checker was so helpful. I told the manager that really brightened the checker's day. Since then, my husband and I have made a point of recognizing those people who go out of their way to make our life a little easier. At Disney World, I handed out lots of little thank yous to the photographer who created the perfect shoot, the bus driver who sang songs, the cast members who delighted our granddaughters by calling them princesses. I even found that I could post a message on the park's official Twitter account with the hashtag #castcompliment. It's easy and fun to show your appreciation when someone has gone above and beyond for you. Well, we are out of time, but I would like to leave you with a quote by Lisa Jo Baker from her book, The Middle Matters. You are loved by a God who delights in you and calls you good, not because of what you've done, but because of who you are. I'm Sean Scott. Thank you for listening. And until next time, may we all be refreshed.